In many counties, it will take days, even weeks, for a final ballot count, but results of California's 11 ballot measures have been called. So much money was spent on these campaigns. On Inside Cap Radio, reporter Sammy Kayola takes us through the votes and those dollar figures. At Loaves and Fishes Friday, there is a Veterans Day salute to veterans who are homeless. Also ahead is Loaves and Fishes Thanksgiving dinner and the holiday sock drive. There are ways that you can help. We'll talk about that. Jeff Jardine will take us through his compilation of veterans' war stories. The stories were gathered while he was a columnist at the Modesto Bee. And the new book in which these stories appear is titled Home to the Brave. Then Nick Bruner brings us this week's sound advice. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our show, as you might know, was preempted yesterday by coverage of the press conferences by President Trump and California Congressmember Nancy Pelosi. You can, however, find my post-election conversations with Ken Rudin and Ben Adler. They are at capradio.org/insight. Also, Cap Radio's election results and coverage are continually being updated on the website, so be sure to check in there if you're still following for some news. 11 ballot propositions were on this California midterm ballot. The tallying isn't officially done, but the yeses and noes have essentially been called in these ballot measures. Cap Radio reporter Sammy Kayola is here. We're going to run through what we know and what was spent. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, Beth.
I do have to say that because you're here, I want to acknowledge and take advantage of the fact that I can have a little bit different conversation with you this morning. Our country, and California in particular, is dealing with another mass shooting. This is the tragedy that happened overnight in Thousand Oaks. 12 people were killed. The suspect has been identified as a Marine Corps veteran who supposedly exhibited signs of post-traumatic stress. This affects so many people, as we know. And in some of your reporting, you've dealt with this and issues related. So I thought that we should bring up the fact that we do offer resources. We want to offer some direction for somebody who might be struggling.
Yeah, that's a great idea, Beth. I have worked with veterans who suffer from PTSD or anger management issues, depression, and if those things don't get treated, it really can lead to some violent situations. So there's always the Veterans Crisis Line. That's 1-800-273-8255. And I know if you go online to capradio.org, we're going to have some other resources listed out. The Sacramento Vet Center offers group counseling pretty much every day of the week. There are anger management sessions offered in Sacramento, and there are also resources for people who maybe live with a veteran who are worried about gun safety. And there are ways that you can protect a loved one from their own guns. So you can find those resources online.
These will be posted. I think I'll give you that 24-hour veteran crisis line one more time. It's 1-800-273-8255. Again, that's 800-273-8255. All right, now we're shifting gears and we're going into some of the politics, which has dominated the week. These results of the California ballot proposition, some which seemed known by the trend pretty immediately on election night. But what an astonishing amount of money spent on this election cycle. You know, what's that big overall total of millions, Sammy?
Yes, I did all the math this morning. It's a total of about $386.2 million on all of the propositions total.
Wow.
So, and you had a couple that were really big spenders. Proposition 8 was the biggest one with $131.8 million. And then also Prop 10 at $102.5 million. Mm. But so, yeah, a couple really standouts there, but $386.2 is the big one.
There were housing issues scattered across the ballot. There were some completely unrelated topics. If you don't mind, let's just kind of go down the list. Sure. And let's talk about vote totals and money spent. Let's start with Prop 1, which happened to be a veterans and affordable housing bond. This was an act of 2018, specifically under this umbrella of housing measures. And what did voters say?
So voters ultimately said yes. This was one of the closer ones, though. As of yesterday, we didn't know. It was kind of up 54% to 46%, but the supporters ended up coming out on top, and that's a yes. So we're going to see some more housing built.
And there's a total of how many bonds involved in this measure?
Okay, so let's see. Prop 1 is a bond. Prop 2 is a bond. Prop 4 is a bond. Prop 3 was a bond, but it failed. So there are at least three bonds that passed.
So yeah. Prop number 1 is almost $5 billion in state bonds. Let's go to Proposition number 2, which is one of those that was a throwback to something earlier that voters had decided. This was the throwback to 2004, Prop 63, which some people know as the millionaire tax.
Right, or the Mental Health Services Act. So this one's a bond, but it was sort of money that's already been set aside, but it was set aside for mental health services. So the big debate on this one was, well, should we be spending this money for housing? Though it's housing that is going to include mental health services. So that debate played out between, you know, housing developers and mental health advocates, and it ended up at a yes. So we are going to see some housing built for the chronically homeless and the mentally ill.
Okay, then we switched to a water bond, which at one point over the last year or two got a lot of attention. But when it came to the ballot box, voters looked at it and said...
They said no. And this was another close one. We didn't have the answer on election day. We had to wait. It was down, and it did end up being a no. I think there was just a lot of skepticism around that bond money. It was a lot of money. We'd recently had a water bond passed. And, you know, some people saw these as special projects that were only for one region of California that maybe not all Californians should be paying for. That was the opposition, and they ended up prevailing here.
It would have issued almost $9 billion of general obligation bonds, and these were toward, as you say, different water projects. And I think it is possible that voters, maybe who aren't studying deeply or even those who are, look at the amount of money in those bonds. And in a number of these ballot measures, as you say, you start doing the math, and it's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, no, all these bonds combined, it's, you know, it can definitely be a sticker shock when you're going through your propositions.
All right, another bond, Proposition 4, the Children's Hospital Bond.
Yeah, this is $1.5 billion that has been approved by voters. So that's going to go toward helping 13 children's hospitals in California improve their infrastructure, get new equipment, or meet seismic compliance. That's a big thing they've had to grapple with. And this is one I reported on, actually. And a lot of the children's hospitals told me they have more kids than ever on Medi-Cal due to the expansion and just more people enrolling. So they, you know, had asked the state for a little help to cover those kids and to make these hospitals safe, and they got it.
The state has already been involved. This wasn't a brand new method or way to help in particular children's hospitals. The state's had a role ongoing, which was some of the no argument, I think.
Right. There have been bonds for this purpose before. So these have always sort of been state supported hospitals. And some people may be pushed back against that.
But. So what was the percentage of the vote on that?
Oh, that one I don't have.
Okay. But
right
that
here.
Was a yes.
It was a yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Prop 5, again, this is a throwback. Prop 5 related in its description to Prop 13 rules, and it would have changed the Prop 13 rules going back to 1978. So 5 had a lot of attention, a lot of money to it, but it was specific to seniors being defined as people over age 55.
Yeah, that was my understanding, was if you were over age 55, this was going to limit the way that you, or sorry, it would have expanded whether your property tax break would transfer if you got a new home. Currently, it will transfer, but only if you move within your county, if you move to a home of the same or lesser value, and if you're only moving once. And so this was an effort to sort of give seniors more flexibility over that, or people over 55. More options to transfer their tax break. But yeah, they're out of luck here.
Yeah, I think voters didn't want to tamper with Prop 13 or else didn't want to deal with this specific language. But that one was a no. On to Prop 6. Just before our program began, we heard part of the press conference and remarks that Governor Jerry Brown made yesterday to reporters. And in particular, he had staked a lot of his election effort toward Prop 6.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of projects planned, a lot of projects in the works that are pretty reliant on this Prop 6 funding, and it looks like those are going to be able to move forward. The effort to repeal that gas tax failed, so that gas tax will stay in place.
And so this is one where the no meant a yes,
yes,
that you had to read carefully. So there was some conversation going around that maybe the reason that voters went the way they did was because they weren't sure what they were voting on. The governor yesterday said people did know what they were voting on. That was his statement. In any event, this Prop 6, because it has failed, the tax is in place now, and as they were set by law, will stay.
You've got it, Beth.
All right. On to Prop 7. This was the fun one in the group, right?
This was the fun one in the group. And so far as I can tell, I don't think anyone spent money on this because maybe not that it shows in the records. I guess it's sort of a just a casual proposition. Well, people feel passionately about it.
I was going to say, even though we say fun, it was very important to people. There's a series of five steps that would need to happen for daylight saving time to become a permanent change in California. So this was technically step number 2 of 5.
I think so. So, yeah, we want to be clear. A lot of people thought, oh, Prop 7 passed, so daylight saving is over, or daylight saving is permanent now. It's neither. Nothing happens right now, except what Prop 7 did was it repealed a prior act that held us to our current daylight saving time structure. And now that that act has been repealed, now California can move forward to create a different arrangement. So that is going to take an act of the legislature. It's going to need, to be voted on. It's going to need to be approved by the governor, and then it's going to need congressional approval. So it could be a very long time before anything changes regarding daylight saving, and we don't even know what the change would be. That's up to lawmakers.
But voters did resoundingly, by a high percentage, say, in fact, yes, we want to match the code here to federal law. So step number 2 passes.
It passes, yeah.
I'm talking with Cap Radio's healthcare reporter Sammy Caola. By the way, I want to add a thank you to Pauline Bartolone, who was Cap Radio's healthcare reporter some years ago. She had volunteered to come back and help us out on election night. We had such a vast team everywhere. It was great to see her back in the newsroom. I know it's always nice when the two of you get to see each other, too.
Yeah, it was a nice reunion.
So let's move on to Prop number 8. This is another one that you spent so much time on, Sammy.
Oh, I was pulling my hair out over Proposition 8, but it failed. It was actually the most expensive by far this year. There was a total of $138 million spent here, most of it spent by the dialysis companies that opposed the measure. So just a quick catch up. This was a measure that would have capped what dialysis companies can spend on their overhead and administrative costs versus what they have to put toward patient care. So you had dialysis patients and dialysis staffers, labor unions actually, put forth this measure that they wanted to see more costs funneled into patient care. But yeah, the dialysis companies fought it. There was a lot of concern about how these spending caps would affect clinics, and it ultimately failed.
I think when you say you were pulling your hair out, part of it was that a lot of this proposition was about what if. If this happens, then will this happen? If this happens, then will these people die? And so being able to explain and be specific is where the challenge was.
There was a lot of speculation on this prop. Yeah, the financial ramifications were not totally clear. So confusing for me and confusing for voters, I'm
prop
sure.
Prop 8 did not pass.
Did not pass.
All right. We skipped number 9. Okay, this is Mary Beth Moylan's joke from the McGeorge students who reviewed the ballot measures. 7, 8, 9. I get no reaction from Sammy. That's what I did when
I haven't had my full cup of coffee yet today.
So we get to go on to 10, the Affordable Housing Act.
Oh, 7, 8, 8, 9. So there isn't a 9.
You got it.
I got it. Delayed reaction.
Don't worry. It took all of us a moment or two. You actually got it. I know Mary Beth is laughing right now. All right, Professor Moylan, you got another giggle. Prop 10.
Yes, Prop 10, the rent control measure. There was a lot of conversation about this in cities throughout California that want to impose rent control. For that to have happened, this prop, if it passed, it would have repealed a prior act, the Costa-Hawkins Act, I believe it's called.
Yes, it is.
Yes, the Costa-Hawkins Act, which would have given local governments much more freedom to enact rent control. But it failed. It's a no. Though I have, you know, heard that there might still be rent control happening in cities. They might still try to make it work. I know some affordable housing advocates in Sacramento did tell the Sacramento Bee that they fully intend to go forward with the plans we've been reporting on. But there will be some restrictions there. They won't be able to put rent control on units built after 1995, and it won't apply to single-family residences being used as a rental unit. So,
in the California Today column in the New York Times, one of the paragraphs begins with the line, "Where does California housing go from here?" More of the same, but with different details. And I think that's speaking to the new leadership, the governor-elect, but also what you just said, cities across the state, once they knew the verdict of Prop 10, had plans in motion for what they might do on their own.
Yeah, they'll just have to finagle around some of these restrictions that are going to stay in place.
All right, let's wrap it up with 11 and 12. 11 was, for some people, the shorthand, the ambulance proposition.
Yeah, this is a fairly straightforward proposition. It's about whether ambulance workers should stay on call during their meal and rest breaks. And it was tied to some larger legal issues. It was sponsored by this ambulance company. They were worried they were going to face a lot of lawsuits over this. And so they wanted to get this in a proposition to say, yes, these workers should stay on call during their breaks. And this passed.
Voters said yes to that one, liked the idea. And number 12 was, again, the shorthand, the farm animals proposition.
Yeah, the farm animals proposition. This, I'm an animal person. This was dear to me. But yeah, this passed. So farms that sell meat and eggs are going to have to expand the amount of space that their animals have. So it's not just I'm just going to look this up real quick. I don't know the specifications of the space, but they're going to have more space. And then there was something in there about, yes, egg-laying hens have to be in cage-free housing by 2022.
All
so,
right.
Yeah.
There was more in that. It dealt with calves being raised for veal and breeding pigs. There's much more explanation on our website of each proposition and with, again, and that was a yes also.
That was a yes.
So we had 6 yeses, 5 noes, the summary at capradio.org. It was a lot to keep track of, a lot of money spent. But Sammy, thanks for the summary. And again, I'll remind everybody that there are resources in that separate situation that has been unfolding overnight in Thousand Oaks. Please go to capradio.org for more.
Thanks for having me, Beth.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Veterans Day in the United States is November 11th, but because that falls on a Sunday this year, the holiday is also being observed on Monday, November 12th in many ways. Loaves and Fishes in Sacramento has planned a Veterans Day salute to homeless vets. That's happening tomorrow, Friday, November 9th. And it's one of a number of events and ways that you can get involved with Loaves and Fishes. In the studio with me is its executive director, Noel Kammerman. Hi, Noel.
Hi.
Glad
thanks for having us
here. Also, Calla Haley Clark, who is the development director. Hi, Calla.
Hi. Good morning.
So we are talking about the situation that happened in Thousand Oaks and veterans issues. PTSD now will be on the minds of many people over this weekend. What have you learned about the mental health struggles of veterans? And veterans do make up a portion of your clientele. Noel?
Yeah, so at Loaves and Fishes, about 13% of the guests that we serve each and every day are veterans. And just a little bit of background information as well. Between 2015 and 2017, there was actually a 50% increase in veteran homelessness in the Sacramento area. So there is a massive need out there for services for vets. And then what we're finding is that folks who find themselves without a home are outside for a very, very long time. And people who fall into homelessness, there's a good chance that they're going to be there for quite some time. And what happens is that the longer that someone stays in that situation where they're without a home, without shelter, without that connection to services, the longer they stay out there, the more medical, mental health, and substance abuse issues that you typically see with folks, because a lot of times there's trauma that happens day in and day out that people are trying to cope with. There is just a major difficulty in terms of trying to get attached to any kind of mental health or substance abuse or medical care. And for folks who they're not really sure where their next meal is going to be, they're not really sure where they're going to sleep that night, if they're going to be safe, it becomes more and more difficult to try and connect those folks to care because they don't have that basic stability and ability to even just get into those appointments. Even if they have something scheduled, even if they have something connected with them, there's nowhere to plug in an alarm clock. There's nowhere to plug in cell phones out there on the streets. And so you have a lot of folks that are in a very desperate situation, and the consequences of it are quite sobering.
So that spike, 2015 to 2017, by then, you're seeing a rolling impact of what was happening in prior years, both in America's involvement with troops in the war and people coming home, and the economic crunch that was hitting us starting yes. back to 2007, correct?
Yes. No, there's been a number of things that have kind of hit us in California and in Sacramento, just one after another. And the folks who are community's most vulnerable folks, they're seeing probably the worst effects of it.
Does Loaves and Fishes have or direct veterans with PTSD issues to specific resources? Your organization has been a community help for so long, and it's a survival service organization. So we've mentioned a couple resources. We have them on the website. But do you want to add to what we're talking about today?
I mean, it really depends when folks come to us for assistance, depending on what their needs are. We try to meet everyone where they're at. So if someone is coming in and if they need medical care or mental health care or substance abuse care, some of that is our services that we provide ourselves. Some of that is provided by community partners that we have. So if it's more on the medical side, maybe we connect them with Mercy Clinic and they start getting in touch with the Sacramento County nurses who staff that program on our campus. If it is someone who needs mental health counseling, we also have Genesis Mental Health Clinic on site, and we'll provide free mental health counseling to anyone who wants it. And a lot of times that also results in a referral out for psychiatric mm-hmm. services as well if they need medication. Substance abuse issues as well. We have community partners depending on, what the need is, maybe if they have insurance, that can open them up to one set of services. If they have no insurance, that opens them up to another set of services. I think what we're also seeing, though, is that there are a number of organizations that are trying to provide as much as they can. And the number of people who are queuing up for those services, it's overwhelming. And so you're seeing a lot of folks who maybe they can't get the appointment right away. Maybe it's a week later. Maybe it's a month later. Maybe it's a couple months later. And it really speaks to kind of the level of crisis of homelessness that we're seeing out there today.
Calla, this event tomorrow is becoming a tradition. I believe tomorrow is the third year of this honoring of homeless vets. What's the game plan? Who's invited to participate?
Well, any of our guests who have served in any of the armed forces are welcome to come. We are expecting Mayor Daryl Steinberg and Congressman Ami Barra as well are going to be there. It's going to start with welcome remarks from Noel, of course, and a blessing from our former executive director, Sister Libby. And then there will be a solemn pinning ceremony for any of the veterans in our staff, our volunteers, and of course, our guests.
This is 10 o'clock, Friday, November 9th, at the Memorial Wall at Friendship Park.
Yes, that's right.
Because you mentioned the mayor, I want to bring up another topic. The city council is taking a look at what happens if the city of Sacramento declares a shelter crisis and the funds that would be triggered and available. How is Loaves and Fishes part of that picture?
We're not directly a part of that picture, and because since we don't receive any government funding ourselves, but what benefit we see to the community, it's going to be just under $20 million worth of additional resources that are going to be brought to this community. And it's state money through a couple programs called HEAP and KESH. Those are the acronyms, and I couldn't tell you exactly the what they stand for right away. But I do know that it opens up additional resources for shelter funding, for additional services right away for folks. It opens up rental assistance dollars as well for folks who are experiencing homelessness. And then there's also some system infrastructure improvements that can be made. And so it's really a joint partnership between the city, the county, and Sacramento Steps Forward, who's kind of, trying to take the lead in coordinating all of this. But it depends, our access to these funds depends on our city and county declaring a shelter crisis. And if they don't do that, then we're leaving $20 million on the table. And that would be money very well spent for the folks that are experiencing homelessness in our community here.
That's Noel Kammerman. He's the executive director of Loaves and Fishes in Sacramento. Also, Calla Haley Clark is here, and she is development director. If we jump ahead a couple weeks, the annual Thanksgiving dinner that you serve to the community, to homeless people in the streets, happens the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. So it's the 20th this year.
That's right. We don't want to wait. In fact, our dining room is usually the first point of service that any of our guests actually access, because the hunger is the most primary need we serve, and it's the largest need we serve. We welcome anywhere between 400 and 800 people on average every single day.
But on Thanksgiving for this dinner,
well over 1,000.
Right. There are people in the community who want to help. I know folks volunteer to serve on that day. How can people get involved?
Well, there are a number of different ways, and the most effective way, of course, is donating. Like Noel said, we don't accept any government funding, and that allows us at our organization to, like he said, meet our guests where they are and respond to their needs in turn. They're often with government grants, can't be enough wiggle room or ways to be creative and ways to really meet people as individuals. So the best thing that anyone can do is donate. Like, for example, the cost of a specialty cup of coffee, just under $5, will serve somebody a hearty breakfast and lunch, two meals for the cost of a cup of coffee. But like I said, we see 400 to 800 people a day for lunch. So that's a lot of proverbial cups of coffee. You can also pitch in for our holiday meals. We have a list of food items that we need, and we particularly this year need turkeys. We had a benefactor for several years who would give us several hundred turkeys who unfortunately can't participate this year. So we're a little behind on the curve. So if you feel like dropping off a turkey, our warehouse is open 7 a.m. to 2:45 p.m. Monday through Friday.
I think it's easy to remember mornings is a good drop-off time for you because you open so early, so on the way to work or at lunchtime, and then you're open. That warehouse is 1351 North C Street, so it is in the area of the Loaves and Fishes facility itself. Other ways that people can help. The sock drive is coming up.
Yes, the sock drive is huge. Socks and underwear are the number one requested item of any nonprofit that assists the homeless and the low-income folks. That's the way they get around. Most people don't have a bike or a car. They're on their feet. And like Noel said, there are so many different places that they need to go, so many different appointments to keep, so many different things to do, that their socks wear out pretty quickly, and they also don't have a place to wash them unless they come to our men's wash house and do a load of laundry. But those washers and dryers fill up very quickly. So we're looking for socks in all sizes, mostly athletic socks, cold weather socks. It's better if they are not ankle socks. Those just seem to fall apart the quickest. And those also can be dropped off at our warehouse, or they can be, if you prefer not to come down or you just don't have the time, you can also order them on Amazon or order them online and just send them directly to us at 1351 North C Street.
Gift cards work too, I know, as donated items. So the sock drive goes on. Christmas meal will bring everybody back around to the center. But in terms of helping with turkeys for Thanksgiving, next Friday, to put a little urgency on it, next Friday is the deadline for the planning and preparation of the meals for Thanksgiving, correct?
That's right. At that point, our kitchen will be working literally around the clock for several days to make sure that we have all the food ready for everybody.
Okay. Noel, I guess I'll just come back around to where we started in the beginning, and that is that in terms of people needing help on the street, we often focus on women and children. This is an ideal time, really, to think about veterans.
Oh, of course. No, veterans, it's interesting because the community that I came from out east, we were able to actually get to functional zero on veteran homelessness. And when you go out to Connecticut, there are no homeless vets. So it was when I first started here about a year and a half ago, it was incredibly sobering to come here and arrive in a situation where we don't even, I mean, we not only have many homeless vets, but there was a 50% increase in homeless veterans in the community here. And so it is certainly a priority of mine. I think it's many people's priorities to try and help address this need, because the impact to these folks, these men and women who have served our country, it's critical that they are taking care of their home, but they're homeless. And that is not a situation that any one of them should find themselves in. And so it's critical that we do what we can to help them.
Thank you both for being here. It was pre-planned, but it was serendipitous timing, I think, for all that's going on today. Glad to have the conversation with you both. Noel Kammerman is Executive Director of Loaves and Fishes. Calla Haley Clark is Development Director. We'll post a link to the information we just talked about so you can find out more about the services schedule and about ways to donate. That will be at capradio.org/insight. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.
This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. This Veterans Day also marks the 100th anniversary of the ending of World War I. Memories and mementos of the United States war history have been passed from generation to generation, sometimes to journalists who collect and document this history. And that's the case for writer Jeff Jardine. You might have followed his years of columns in the Modesto Bee. He's compiled a number of them in a really beautiful, astonishing new book titled Home to the Brave: Remembrances of War Brought Home to One Small Dot on a Map. And Jeff is in the studio.
Hi, Beth.
Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Will you tell me more about that title, Remembrances Brought Home to One Small Dot on the Map?
Well, as a local columnist of the Modesto Bee, everything I did needed to be local. And over the years, I had been writing these columns about the military veterans and they're telling their stories. And not only their stories, but stories about things that happened in Modesto. One of the columns that goes back as far as World War I was a woman who had letters from both her grandfather and her father. Grandfather had been in World War I, her father had been in World War II. And what I needed to do is, I didn't want to just tell war stories. I wanted to tell war stories that involved the home front. Another one was what Modesto was like the day of the Pearl Harbor bombing. Mm-hmm. And I found people who remembered the Modesto Bee paperboy selling the extras on the streets and wrote about that. The funny thing is that in our own files, in our own morgue, we didn't have a copy of our extras.
Wow.
So I was able to find a retired editor named Ray Nish, who since passed, and he had the copies of the extras, and we were able to get a hold of those and use them in the book and write about it.
Sometimes these are stories that the veterans hadn't told anyone else. They were willing to talk to you in a way that they hadn't even talked to their own family members.
And that happened. I had sons calling me and saying, gosh, you got stuff out of my dad I'd never heard. And sometimes maybe that little bit of detachment from the family is what enabled them to do it. I think a lot too, was they were doing oral histories at the time and getting a lot of this stuff recorded. Museums were doing it. The McHenry Museum did it in Modesto. And I think maybe people were just a little bit more free to talk or feeling free to talk than they had been before.
Mm. A particular column from May of 2010 was titled "Rendering Final Salute, a Solemn Job." And this was a story told to you by Bill Barr.
Mm-hmm.
Say a little bit more about Bill Barr and what his unique role was.
Bill had enlisted at the end of World War II. He was very young. He got into the Army, and they mustered him right out when the war ended. Well, he couldn't find a job, so he went back into the military and became a military escort. And a military escort takes remains home for burial. And so I think he was in Chicago, and it was a huge warehouse, four floors high, full of remains. They would assign him a casket, and he would take that casket home, put it on a train, go wherever they had to go. In many cases, he would stay at the house of the deceased soldier because they were going to have that casket lie in state so that the neighbors, friends, and relatives could come pay their final respects. So he would be literally staying in that soldier's bedroom. He would be looking at the girlfriend's picture, the Little League uniform, the football uniform, the trophies, sitting right there.
That's such a detail.
Yeah, right.
I think the sense of place in that is really palpable.
Well, Bill went on to work for the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and had a long career there. And after he retired, a lot of the things that he'd built up came out, and he went to the Modesto Vet Center, which was a PTSD counseling daily clinic. There's no beds. It's not a facility like that. He just got daily counseling, either in group or individual. And he agreed to tell us his story, and it was amazing because he had held this stuff in for so long, but he actually was so affected by these moments with these families. Sometimes the dads would scream at him and blame him for their son's death, or why are you here and he isn't? And it built up on him, and he ended up enlisting to fight in Korea rather than do this anymore. And a number of the escorts did the same thing. And he went to a reunion a few years later, or right around the time I interviewed him, and there were only three of them left. They had all expired over time after having done this, and almost all of them had also gone to Korea.
Jeff, would you read part of the end of that column? I think I need to direct you to page 34. Each of these stories could be read. Each of these stories has such a powerful theme to it. But if you wouldn't mind, a little bit more of Bill Barr's story.
And Bill begins by saying, "I didn't make friends," he said. "I didn't talk to anybody. I'd go from one day to the next, and it was a good day if you made it till the next." Captured by the North Koreans and Chinese, he escaped and found his way back to his unit about a month later. While in Korea, he ran into a soldier he had known from Fort Sheridan, who was among the many military escorts invited to Barr's wedding in 1948. They were the only two escorts still alive from that day. All the others had died in Korea. Quote, "And of the 300 men who were military escorts, maybe 50 survived the Korean War," Barr said, which is why now Barr won't attend Memorial Day services at the National Cemetery in Santa Anella or anywhere else. He's endured too much death and brought too many young men home for their final salute. To this day, he remembers the sadness of each service as if it happened yesterday, handing yet another folded Old Glory to yet another grieving mother. This is your flag, presented to you by the order of the President of the United States and a grateful nation in memory of the supreme sacrifice of your son, he can still recite without pause. You took your hat off, you touched the casket, you gave the final salute, and then you backed away.
That is from one of the many columns in Jeff Dardeen's new book, Home to the Brave, Remembrances of War Brought Home to One Small Dot on the Map. Jeff is a former columnist for the Modesto Bee. He was a longtime sports reporter, too. He has retired from almost a 40-year career in journalism. And you've got a couple events. I know people love meeting you again and talking with you, and your books will be available. Saturday, you're at the Commemorative Air Force Breakfast, and that's the general aviation side of the city-county airport.
Right, Modesto.
In Modesto. And then Sunday, you're at the Modesto Veterans Day celebration in...
That's in Modesto at Crusader Park.
Crusader Park.
And then I'll go down to one in Turlock in the afternoon. And also on Saturday, I'll be out at the little Waterford Museum, neat little museum out there. And I'm going to talk to some of those folks and see if they'll buy a few books.
You have a couple of speaking engagements, November 13th, the Turlock Tuesday Reading Club, the 14th. To the SIRS Sons in Retirement, and then the 17th, the American Revolution in Lathrop. I do want to add that relationships, as I read the columns, were a powerful theme. People who were finding each other or passing information or stories from family member to family member, or just being inspired by each other. And these are war stories, but Jeff, these are really amazing people stories.
I think, you know, one of my favorite stories in the book, if you remember the movie Unbroken, it was Laura Hillebrand's book that Angelina Jolie did. Well, that was the story of Louis Zamperini, whose plane crashed. He was actually out looking for another downed pilot, and his plane crashed, and he spends 47 days on the water and finally floats into an island with a Japanese prison camp on it. He ends up being taken to Japan. We have a gentleman in Modesto. He's got to be 97, 98 years old now, named Leroy Myers. And he went through the exact same kind of thing, except that he was on Wake Island as an individual contractor, private contractor, building docks and whatnot. And he got captured by the Japanese when they swarmed Wake Island 15 days after Pearl Harbor and was sent to be slave labor on a dam in Japan with his father, who was also a contractor.
Wow.
Now, their story is amazing because when you are captured, you become a member of the military. Well, there was a mistake over who was supposed to be paying his paycheck, the military or the contractor, and it didn't get paid. So his mom is home at their ranch in Redding and loses the ranch to foreclosure. Mm. And she dies not knowing that her husband and her son were still alive in Japan, and they came home not knowing she had passed and lost the ranch.
Mm.
And so these stories just hit me as hard as they I think they hit some of the people themselves in many respects, because you knew that you were telling a story that needed to be told.
There's
to be
so
preserved.
Much in this book. I think it's an archival documentation for the area. And Jeff, I thank you so much for sharing it with us today. I know people appreciate that their family member stories are here. So you will be out and about. We'll post links to where you're going to be over the next number of days. Thanks for all your great work in journalism over the years, too.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. That is Jeff Jardine. His book is titled Home to the Brave. There's more at capradio.org/insight. And a final thank you to the men, the women, the families, everybody who has given service and in some cases his or her life to our country to continue to make this life in this country possible for all of us. Thank you to you too, Jeff.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.
Notice how the door closes when the chimes of freedom ring. Hear what you're saying. I hear what he's saying. Is what was true now no longer so.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Just a heads up that there are some mandatory evacuations in effect for a rural area of Butte County. There is a wildfire that has grown to about 1,000 acres, we're told. Of course, the weather's warm and it's very windy right now. An area around Paradise and the tiny town of, I should know this, is it Pulga? I think the little town there is being evacuated as well. CHP is closing some highways. So our newsroom is on this. Stay alert in the area if that is where you are or where you're traveling through. You know, it's been such an intense week that I think music can be soothing to your mind if it feels a little wrung out right now. Nick Bruner hosts Hey Listen on Saturday nights on Cap Radio. I end up hearing the program often as I'm coming or going from something, and I always hear music that is not only contemporary, but often unplayed or unheard anywhere else. So, Nick, glad to have you here.
Hey, you just summed up the whole ethos of the show.
Well, I enjoy it. I pop in, I dip in and out and think, oh, I never might have been exposed to that if it wasn't for your show.
Hey, well, great. That's kind of the whole deal behind it. I love doing it. So looking forward to bringing you. We got like five tracks here. So
good. Well, let's go. That's this week's Sound Advice.
I just wrote about this one for NPR's Heavy Rotation ran at the beginning of this month. This track was released in 2017, but the album just came out about 2 weeks ago. It's by a musician named Matthew Deer. And he has these like syrupy, resonant, minimal, dark vocals. So I was really surprised when this one started off with the poppy voices of Tegan and Sarah. It's been one of my favorite tracks forever. It's called Bad Ones.
I played a role in all your tears. Eight flowers, but they seem to work on you, my dear. Freaking out and paralyzed. Your body tempts me. I haven't told you lies this year. Would I send you flowers if my love was insincere? Freaking out and paralyzed. Your body takes me.
If I was one of the good ones, I don't think you'd like me. I'm one of the bad ones.
It's worth waiting for those voices. Everybody is already just bouncing and mellow, just with a minute of music.
That record's so good. It's this kind of like poppier departure for him. He's always had music that's been catchy and bouncy, but this has just been, it's just noticeably more, I don't know, light and airy. Could have had something to do with the fact he became a father twice between his last record and this one. Mm-hmm. He talks about that. But overall, it's just a great listen.
Say the title of it again.
The album is called Bunny, and the song is called Bad Ones, featuring Tegan and Sarah.
Okay, what's next?
Charles Bradley passed away last year. He was earned the nickname the Screaming Eagle of American Soul, and here's why. This album is called Black Velvet, and the track is called Slip Away. He's over his career, he had earned comparisons to Otis Redding and James Brown, and his whole catalog is easy to see. I was glad that they were able to put out at least one more record featuring his music because
Charles
he was taken
Bradley.
Way too soon. Yeah.
All right. Another?
An alter ego. This is a guy named Jerry Paper. He just released his album called Like a Baby. It's the alter ego of Lucas Nelson. And, I'll just play this for you and see what you think. I like to refer to that as sort of like woozy Kmart pop. It's like he's reaching through a time warp and he just pulls out this piece of music that sounds like it belongs as you're just like strolling through the aisles. The track's called Losing the Game. It's by Jerry Paper. And his album is Like a Baby.
His voice kind of made me go, wait, what?
Yeah.
What?
it's great. I love it to death.
That's Nick Bruner. We're into this week's sound advice with two more tracks.
This one's by a duo called Warm Drag. They're an electronic group that makes gritty Western swing. This was a fun little find. I had no idea what this group was about. This was just a random disc that was submitted. I popped it in and just was immediately enamored. And it turns out there's a local connection, too, because the drummer for this group also is the drummer for Chick Chick Chick, which has connections here to SAC, and a group called VOCs with Bay Area connections. And the funny thing is he doesn't actually drum in this group at all. He just uses two synthesizers to make everything you heard. And then the vocals come from this woman named Vashti Windish.
What's the name of the album again?
It's self-titled. It's called Warm Drag.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. We have time for one more.
Elvis Costello kind of came out of nowhere this year. He came out of quiet pop retirement. He released a record about 5 years ago with The Roots, but there was no like Elvis Costello solo material out there for about 10 years. He said he was sort of done with that. And then he had a heart attack. And then he kind of came back from that quietly, just as he kind of quietly kept that heart attack under wraps. And he released this record with the Imposters called Look Now.
You should do the things that they say about me. They're saying she's no better than she needed to be. They don't know that he was kind.
Glad to have that back.
Oh, man. Isn't it great?
Love that voice.
Takes it right back. It sounds like he didn't miss a beat.
Yeah, that's wonderful. All right, Nick, the show is Saturday night.
You bet.
Thanks for joining us for this week's Sound Advice.
Pleasure to be here, Beth. Thanks.
That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer today, thank you very much, Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.